Exodus is the prototype of Easter, and God is pursuing you. So if you get a tap on the shoulder, you have heard the most important thing that you need to hear this morning. Just in case you get to stay longer, I'll jump into the talk right now. I want to give credit to theologian John Stevenson in Florida for the charts and order of a lot of the thinking. If you like charts, Precepts Austin is a great place to go for those. I also highly recommend the Bible Project. It's just a great way for either the short overview or for their longer class on the beginning books of the Bible. I'm not going to be spending a lot of time on these overview type topics just because there are so many excellent overviews out there. There's a book of the Echoes of Exodus by Alistair Roberts and Andrew Wilson. It is a great book just to get your heart and mind thinking of the patterns of redemption that we see throughout Scripture. We are an Exodus-shaped people, and it's good to be able to see that throughout all of the Scriptures. Has anyone been together?
as much as the Israelites were right to fear in the desert, it's also where they saw God closest to them. He was their shade by day. He was their fire by night. He was bread from the ground. He was meat from the sky. And he was water from the rock. He himself is the impossible life when I was in the desert. And he calls them and calls us to himself in this impossible place. Exodus is about walking in miracles, more miracles than anywhere else in the Old Testament. And for millions of people in the world, this is the story of God. When they think of themselves and define their story, they are defined by the Exodus. It has sweeping themes, like all the sweeping themes. Rescue, freedom, the God who comes to be with us, how do we live in the presence of perfection? It is the story of God versus gods and the Almighty's pursuit of his own permit. We will study God's faithfulness. We will study true freedom, epic battles, and the mind-numbing demon. It is narrative, but it's not like any other story because it was never meant to stay on the page. We're going to be asking this year that through the mentoring and friendship of the Holy Spirit, that Exodus will take residence in our hearts and minds, that we will be filled and understand that this God is pursuing you, forgiving your sin and bringing him to yourself to know him, and that you will upend systems of oppression. So if you're only one sin of time this morning, and this one, then I just come to receive you, to redeem you, and to bring you to himself, and through you, to redeem the world. Like I said, there's a lot of scholarship in Exodus. If you like urban theology, there is a lifetime of rabbit trails to follow. And there's a few different ways to date the time frame of the writing based on different passages, not just in Exodus and not just through the first five books, but you can do that as well. If you like minutia and date, this is your place. The traditional view is that it takes place around 1400 BC. It's credited to Moses with a compilation of letters. In English, we call the book Exodus. It's from a Greek word that means going out. And it points to the context of Israel's release from Egypt. But if you're reading it in Hebrew, the name is Shemot, meaning the names. And it's from the first verse of the book. And these are the names of the sons of Israel who came to Egypt with Jacob. They came to Egypt one with their household from Exodus 1:1. And I love to point this out. For Hebrew readers, it's not a story, but if it is the story, it's their story. It is their names. Their God has called them. The book also falls into two pretty distinct sections. I love this description from one of the commentators, several of them. The first part is the story of getting Israel out of Egypt. The second section, the law, is getting Egypt out of Israel. But let's talk about the Egypt in the first. By 3000 BC, these poor Egyptians had figured out how to irrigate with water and to predict the flooding of the Nile. And this is their first universal lesson in the morning. We all need water. And whoever controls the water has the power. And you see it with a bridge that they will charge a state across it. That's going to become church. The sun never sets on the British Empire. It's going to come from the seas. And in the centuries, the Egyptians consolidated their power over the water. And that meant they had an abundance of food. They could trade. They started mining for salt and other minerals. They developed hieroglyphics and signed one of the first peace treaties ever found. And in controlling the access to the main source of water in the region, they control the region. And into this political and cultural powerhouse, from this new shepherd named David and his remembering writing voice. What's ever going down? I mean, Jacob, I can't really understand. It's that the grandfather of Abraham is the most important man in the world because he is the carrier of God's covenant promise for restoration, for Israel, and then for the world. We often don't realize at the time that one of his sons, Joseph, is prime minister, but that comes later in the story, right? There are few moments in biblical history that get as much airtime as the move to Egypt. And we may know the story that there is Joseph being sold into slavery by his brothers. We get an even closer shot about how they end up leaving Canaan and going into Goshen in Egypt. We hear about the cup and the grain and the brothers and the dinners. We have whole books of the Bible that are shorter than the description of Joseph holding the silver cup in his brother's back. So this is really important to our biblical writers. We need to understand the context of this to know the history that we're working into. The famine is so bad that Jacob leaves his family of 70 in Egypt. And the book of Genesis ends with Joseph's death. This is where the book of Exodus picks up with end. And the story jumps right back in with a recap of Jacob's son. But by verse 8, things are going very badly. The Pharaoh, who didn't know Joseph, came to power. Look, he said to his people, the Israelites have become too numerous for us. Come, we will deal shrewdly with them, or they will become even more numerous. And if war breaks out, we'll join our enemies, fight against us, and leave the country. So a group of people and refugees become the slave class. Pharaoh is wrong. The Israelites are a different ethnic and language group, and they are sitting on the fertile Goshen Valley on the east side, where enemy invaders could attack Egypt on the flank. But what is so cool is the solution of Pharaoh is the solution of every dictator. They were ruthless. I tend to walk past that sentence on my way to getting to the story of Moses, but I just want to stop for a second at the word ruthless. The Hebrew word here is used in Exodus and Leviticus 25 for freeing the Israelites from slavery. It is the one thing we know about an otherwise biblical blank slate for history. They were shaped by centuries of cruelty. Slavery was then and is now a global industry. When the Israelites were in Egypt, about 5% of the population in the Shem dynasty in Shem were enslaved. In Jesus' day, about 40% of the population of what's now Italy were slaves. The Mongolian Empire, the medieval slave markets in Venice and Dublin, the transatlantic trade. I point this out for one reason. I want to pull the lens back for a moment to show the scope of the problem, because if we think that we're talking about one people group at one time, we have wildly underestimated our conception of one another. We as humans have an uninterrupted history of using one another as disposable goods. And the world that holds slavery together is that there's a structure of power that you don't mess with, or you will pay a heavy price. Moses has to flee his homeland, right? I don't think he's killed him yet. I think he could have gone on a rampage against fellow Hebrews. But he has to flee because he's a Hebrew who killed an Egyptian. It just takes a surprising amount of time to outline this transaction. Culture of production quarters, of middle management, promotions and supply chain. This sounds so modern, but this is how you make things in an economy. And you also see how the reactions go. And control, and bullying, and further opposition, and what's smacked down by other management. We're going to get these people in line. Unlike slave classes, they grow up trying their best to work the system, to manipulate it as best they can, and enslave one another, and even dream of holding their skin. In the end of what feels like a suddenly moment, God announces to Moses that he has heard the cries of his people. His patience with the sin of Egypt and the people of Canaan is at an end, and it is time for both judgment and escape. when the Jewish followed it, God is not content for the Israelites to merely leave Goshen. And what's really important for us to understand is he could have done that by something God's heart, shaking the ground, another invading army. In fact, he also could have made it a lot easier if he were willing to make just a few tweaks to the promise. Right? There are Goshen, his people, there's a river. Instead of doing one, I just make it tomorrow. That could be a promise word. There are already Hasidic populations in Canaan. Why not just choose one of them? Or why not plant the whole thing? Because God, and sometimes Moses, will occasionally suggest that is not our kind of God. He will fulfill his promise by upending the system of ruthlessness. Because they are not in Exodus to leave Pharaoh. They are leaving bondage in order to be free to worship. And this is the crux of Exodus. Out of bondage and into worship. Therefore, say to the Israelites, I am the Lord, and I will bring you out from under the yoke of the Egyptians. I will free you from its life to them, and I will redeem you with my outstretched arms and with mighty acts of judgment. I will take you as my own people, and I will be your God. Then you will know that I am the Lord who brought you out from the yoke of the Egyptians, and I will bring you to the land I swore with uplifted hand to give to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. I will give it to you as a possession. And here's the kicker. I am the Lord. Exodus 6. As best we know, God has not spoken to his people since the patriarchs. And now, Moses is a prophet, is there to say that God is a stronger power than Egypt and everything that Egypt has to offer. And right there, he gives an outline for the rest of the book. And it's a thematic statement in this order. I will be your God. I will be your God. And I will bring you to the land I promised a long time ago. I love how Leviticus 26:13 puts it. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt so that you would no longer be slaves to the Egyptians. I broke the bars of your yoke and enabled you to walk with heads held high. In the God of Egypt, which you said is one of the most significant moments in Israel's history. And the Exodus author spent even more time getting them up than it had been in, but we're going to get to the desert, so we're going to keep moving. We are tugging and relenting and hurting with hurt and we are praying for disasters and finally death and the great civil event of the Passover. And Egypt is in mourning. The Israelites took their gold, their livestock, they had east, they took up the fellow country that had been mining and they head to the Red Sea. We're going to work in this city, get some to the other side, and it's just 15 minutes. And then we get to the other part of the structure of the book. So it takes about 19 chapters to get Israel out of Egypt and discovery. As it turns out, that's actually the easy part. It's going to take the rest of Exodus, plus the books of Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy to show how to get Egypt from ruthlessness of their captivity out of Israel. I'm going to quote a Christian artist and teacher, Jeff McRobbie, who's quoting Tim Keller's paraphrase of C.S. Lewis, saying, I'm sure people really want to, but I don't trust it. And like I said, there's two economic systems in the world. There's the economy of hope, which has run away from that. And the economy of heaven has run away from us. God's people have spent centuries in the economy of heaven. And probably this was therefore, right? Literally, your life, your boys in the river, for my security, I stand up. And I will sit and I'll cry to a very different system. This is why the Exodus story is more than just a miraculous story for you. This is the book of Exodus, or Echoes of Exodus. Our redemption story is one in which freedom from is inextricably bound with freedom to. My people are Exodus people. So we know both the pain of oppression and the danger of compromise adultery and immorality in the wilderness. We also know that there's no point of increasing the service of Pharaoh if we are not fruiting the temple floor. From Exodus 19:4, you yourselves have seen what I did to the Egyptians, and how I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. So what does that look like? That shift to ruthlessness, to holiness and love and fellowship and worship and justice? All this is a, I know your lives were viewed as worthless to Egypt, in Egypt, but they're precious to me. So don't kill each other. And by the way, burn a railing around your balcony so that when you fall off, I am the Lord. I know that you've never had anything of your own that couldn't be taken. But by the other box, I can't be in your neighbor's field. I am the Lord. I know you've never been protected by courts. You can't use the courts or the legal system in a way that oppresses the poor. I am the Lord. I know you've been adultery. The people are made in my image. Help them. I am the Lord. I know that you haven't had the awful, beautiful presence of me in your midst, but I want to remind you that the Garden of Eden in the mercy seat is where the Lord is. This is what a tabernacle looks like. I am the Lord. So month after month, they wander, they fight battles, they slide into idolatry, they eat manna, and eat manna, and eat manna. And they drink from the streams of the Lord, and even as their mouths are wet with water from the rock, they continue with an anti-song. We get to know a spiritually bipolar people who go from praise to grumbling. And you can't leave their slavery behind. And they cannot see the God who is literally, literally, right in front of them. So in Numbers 20, as they're quarreling with Moses, they say, if only we had died when their brothers fell dead. Why did you bring us, the Lord's community, into this wilderness and that we and our livestock would die here? Why did you bring us out of Egypt to this terrible place? It has no grain or figs, grapevines or pomegranates. And the first complaint continues on the reading. There is no water to drink. God has not stopped loving Israel, and Israel has not stopped loving Israel. So why is slavery so hard to shake? Notice that when you see the bread of the people they hunt so long in Deuteronomy, well, I'm going to agree with this covenant, and you won't be able to keep it. Because, beloved, what we desperately need is for ourselves to be committed. It's going to take, as we say and as we sing, the better Moses to put away his own captivity. Not God with us. The pillar of cloud and fire that we meet in the tent, as amazing as that was, that is the prototype. That God with us as Jesus, who He Himself becomes our tabernacle. Our Garden of Eden and our mercy seat is where Jesus is. Jesus was soaked in miracles. He was our living water and a bread from heaven. Function exclusively in the economy of heaven. And in this parish, the Lord does his life for us. Why? Because he is so that we can be with him. And we want to spend this time marinating in his love for you and the life that he offers to the world. We will also follow our own capacities as we journey through this book. As I was describing the geology of deserts in the Sinai, that 200-mile-an-hour winds over grace and evaporation in rain, barren, dry, hostile life, situated on three competing tectonic plates, mountains, and masses, and shifting dunes. Did anyone think I was describing Sinai, or was I just describing Wednesday? Because spiritually, this is where we all live. It's not a historical them, it's us. The desert is the place after the Red Sea and before the promised land. It is out of our control. We can't plan. We in your form, in the glory, and in the landscape of giant boulders, of barely mitigated tissue, and of the most beautiful stars. The terrain is against us. The heat is against us. And if you look around you in this room, the women sitting next to you could have both sin cancer and testing. But Greg Thompson, when he was a pastor at Trinity Presbyterian Church, he tried to point out that the desert is where God is most painful. He is touchable and real and theoretical. Think about it this way. When God's Spirit guides the people with a cloud by day and flame by night, the first time in history of the day that you say, like, where is your God? There. Like, right there. He's here. Suffering was tangible. The straw and the mud and the brick making and the mining and the rape and the whips and the overseeing was still tangible. Children in a river, tangible. God will bring them in a tangible sea and into the desert. But here in the desert, He makes the impossible doable. Because He makes them impossible people. He made them living people. They were overrun with any water or food source. But their God keeps them, holds them in a place of utter dependence to become His people. And He will be busy doing the work of nation building and culture building. They will be really learning how to appreciate their identities and their social processes and their priorities. But they don't want to come later. He starts by being the God that they can taste and drink. He is their shade by day and their warmth at night. God will have small streams and pools that He has prepared for each one of us in the months to come. He will have signs and wonders for you and your groups, not because He owes us any of these things, but because He has promised to be our God. So as you meet in your small groups next week and reintroduce yourselves, you can start by saying, these are the names. These are the names of the children of God who came to live. Amen.